The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.
Me here in studio to talk about what's going on, because there is stuff going on. It's always the most difficult program of the year is to get the machine girded up again as we head into the new year. I've two guests who are going to try and help us do that. I've Hugh O'Connell here to my left, who's the political editor with the Sunday Times. He's informed me that he would be working anyway, so he has an additional reason for being here. And I'm also joined by Aisling O'Rourke, who's a well-known podcaster and media lecturer. You're both very welcome, folks. Thanks for coming in.
Good morning.
This is the toughest shift of all. This is only for hardy books.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Oh, right. Absolutely. Okay. We've actually got strangely fulsome and busy newspapers, which is a bit odd. The State Papers are great assistance as ever. Let me just briefly go through a few front page headlines. The Irish Examiner says 4 years for a life is not justice. This is a fatal assault that happened down in Cork. A dreadful account of what happened there. We also have vigil held for Dublin hit and run victims. That's, of course, what happened over in Blanchardstown. Anthony Hogg and Georgina Hogg Moore are survived by two children. Absolutely dreadful stuff. A man has been arrested, and the newsroom will keep you updated on that one. The Indo says flatmates to compete with families for cost rentals. Again, there's a photograph of the Hoggs, the couple there in Blanchardstown on the right hand side. And the Irish Times is talking about a diplomatic offensive and to deal with the incoming Trump administration. That's based on an article written by Taoiseach Simon Harris, who's saying we need an all-out diplomatic and trade offensive to deal with the incoming Trump administration. Right, folks, I'll start with you as the political person in the room. The Simon Harris piece, I suppose, is interesting on one level, that he's the timing of it, that he's obviously decided proactively to do this. The message is, let's talk to Trump, let's sort of build relations. But it sort of peters out a bit after that, in the sense of, what do they want Trump to sort of do, or what's the purpose of the offensive? I was left a little bit, apart from building the normal, the ask as such?
I think there's an acknowledgement, I suppose, that a second Trump administration brings with it a degree of unpredictability. So in a sense that, I guess what Simon Harris is trying to say here is that we have to scale up our diplomatic presence in the United States, both in D.C. and in the consulates across the U.S., with a view to protecting that U.S. investment in Ireland, but also protecting Irish jobs or Irish companies who operate out there, who create tens of thousands of jobs or have created tens of thousands of jobs, and to be prepared really for the potential trade shock of the Trump administration. I mean, we know what his plans are in terms of tariffs and all these things, but whether he actually gets them over the line remains to be seen. So I think what Simon Harris is trying to say basically is that we need to be prepared, scale up our diplomatic offensive, and be prepared to be adaptable and agile in the face of an unpredictable administration. But there should be one kind of core guiding principle, I think, and he makes reference to this in the piece, that Trump is a businessman at heart. He's a deal maker. And really, he is only interested in, and Simon Harris doesn't say this, but my assessment would be that really Donald Trump is only interested in making deals, cutting deals that are advantageous to him, both in terms of his own popularity and the success of his administration. So that is, I suppose, has to be the guiding principle for Ireland's approach to the Trump administration. And I guess within that, wrapped within that, Emmett, is, things like the Occupied Territories Bill, which has already caused unease, I think, amongst US firms. The US Chamber of Commerce has already raised it with Peter Burke, the enterprise minister here. And ratification of that won't go down well, obviously, with Israel, but by the corollary of that, or the knock-on effect of that, rather, is that it might not necessarily go down well in the US either. And so that, I think, has to be considered by the incoming government in the face of huge domestic pressure to ratify or to pass that legislation.
Aisling, I suppose what struck me about this one was there's a slight contradiction at the heart of it, in the sense that it says Donald Trump was notably warm when he was talking to Simon Harris. He was very informed about Ireland, had good diplomatic discussions, and he was very aware in our conversation of how important US and Ireland relations are. So then it kind of leads you to, well, what's with this peace then if it's all so good? So I understand what the Taoiseach is trying to do here, but there was a slight sort of tension in there.
You have to wonder, though, what the overall aim of the peace is. At the moment, the leaders of the parties are supposed to be on Christmas break before returning to negotiations after Christmas. And like you said, there's not all that much in the article itself. It's more a case of, well, we have to keep the relations positive with the US, and well, we kind of know that already. So you wonder what the overarching goal of it really is. Like, at the end of the day, and I think we often talk about Ireland, you know, punching above our weight for a small country, but at the end of the day, we are the seventh largest national investor in the country. We're ahead of China, we're ahead of Canada and Australia in the US in creating thousands of jobs. We actually have a bit more weight behind us than I think we give ourselves credit for as citizens. Look, it'll be very interesting. We will need to be agile, and I suppose that's where historically we've not been great at being agile as a country. We tend to be slow movers. It will be very interesting to see how much Trump manages to achieve in his first number of months in office. Like, he did try and increase or remove the limit on the debt ceiling there before Christmas. That was very quickly clamped down on by Congress. So it's a wait and see at this point in time. It's hard to know what he really will be looking for when he comes in.
I think Simon Harris is making the point, really, that we're moving now from a values-based relationship with the United States to a transactional one. Mm. And so I guess that's the message he's trying to convey now, that the relationship is going to change in the way that it kind of changed between 2016 and 2020. And we did navigate that fairly successfully in terms of protecting the economy.
I think that struck me as well. Lots of layers to this piece. But one of the things that struck me is it's very much Ireland-focused, not EU-focused. It's very much... Yeah. So in other words, is the sort of hint of this is that we can do some kind of bilateral carve-out type deal with Trump and let the Europeans worry about themselves? Because as far as I'm aware, I could be wrong on this, but trade is normally a sort of an EU Commission thing.
It is.
So do you think he's trying to sort of say, maybe we can do our own side deal here?
I don't think he's saying that. I mean, I think in fairness, the piece towards the end does reference the fact that he's looking for engagement between the EU and the US, that there be a trade summit, I think, mm-hmm. between the EU and the US, possibly next year. But if not then certainly when Ireland holds the EU presidency in 2026. So I think he's making that point that it is an EU competency, obviously, and it is something that will have to be done at an EU level. But of course, we know that Ireland and the US have a very unique and, I wouldn't say special relationship, because that's...
Don't tell the British that,
yeah,
please.
That's reserved for the UK. But we certainly have a very unique relationship with the United States. We have that kind of access, that sort of access on St. Patrick's Day that countries of our size can only dream of, that sort of bilateral meeting in the Oval Office, which does come with, and all of the events around that in terms of Enterprise Ireland, the IDA, and all of the agencies who are out there during that period and cutting deals and all these kinds of things. So there is, I suppose, a need to, foster that good relationship and to do so in a time when things are more uncertain. And as I say, like, I wouldn't underestimate the impact of the Occupied Territories Bill in terms of if the new government does push ahead with enacting a version of this, it's not going to go down well in the United States. And it might have knock-on consequences in terms of that relationship.
We'll come on to that one in a second, because we're going to be talking about Sinn Féin. Ashley, the other one is just finally, before we leave Trump, we have Matt Cooper calling him a puppet president, saying he's effectively singularly influenced by Elon Musk, which is, not a wild thing to say. But that relationship, people are kind of preoccupied with the Musk-Trump thing, and will it survive the year ahead?
On the one hand, it's eternally fascinating, the two of them, and how they seem to have coupled up in the last number of months. It'll be very interesting to see, though, how long it lasts, because, Trump is well known for falling out with his best buds, and, the two of them are very, very strong personalities. But it's very worrying to see somebody of Musk's weight and influence internationally getting in the back door to the White House, essentially, and to see him have this department that's not a real department, and what actually that will achieve, that in itself could be quite troublesome, I think, for Ireland. I think more so than we might realise right now, considering just how reliant we are on the tech sector here and his role there. But how long will the relationship last? They're very pally at the moment.
If we're here next Christmas at this date next year, I'd be stunned if they're still best buds. But we'll have to see. Can I direct your attention onto Irish domestic political events? Actually, strangely enough, there's a few bits and pieces knocking around. Sinn Féin, there's been the wife of former Sinn Féin TD, Brian Stanley. Caroline Dwan Stanley has resigned from Laois, the Sinn Féin Laois group. That's a big piece of news. We kind of maybe expected it, but it's bad for Sinn Féin in the sense that the year is not ending on a a positive media piece. It's a negative. Yeah. Right?
No, I mean, and Marilyn McDonald has done a raft of interviews, including myself before Christmas, which have kind of been across the papers in the last few days. But this is obviously not a great news story for Sinn Féin. Caroline Dwan Stanley resigning from the party some months now after Brian Stanley resigned from the party.
A very vivid quote. She says, Lee, Sinn Féin is not a safe place to be.
Yeah, I mean, what Sinn Féin have said in response is that it's not unexpected that this has happened. But, I'm not surprised at the time. I'm almost surprised that it took this long for it to happen. And I would have expected that she would have resigned sooner in solidarity with her husband. I'm not sure if she's just doing this to create kind of another headline, another kind of anti-Sinn Féin headline. But that leaves Sinn Féin without any representation on Laois County Council now, which is a blow for them. And obviously, Brian Stanley was re-elected to the Dáil for the Laois constituency in November. So the party has a job of work to do there in terms of rebuilding in Laois.
Do you think this signals that there's not going to be any rapprochement between Stanley at any point? I think that's very unlikely.
Mm. I mean, I think as Mary Lou McDonald said before Christmas, you know, Brian Stanley made his bed and now he can lie in it. And I think that that's where it stands. And I'd be very surprised if there's a way back for him into Sinn Féin in the coming years. I think that that relationship is sundered now and sundered for good.
He would have a little bit of a chuckle if he joined the new independent constellation of TDs.
Yeah, I think that's unlikely. I mean, I think he's going to join, probably be part of a group of independents who won't be in government and who will be very critical of this government. But I mean, I think what's unique about him is that you won't necessarily see him kind of cozying up to Sinn Féin in the way that other independents might, with a view to being part of that alternative.
Then we have the Sinn Féin leader, as you said, there's an interview podcast in The Examiner, Aisling, where she says there's obviously stuff about the Palestinian conflict in Gaza. She's also saying she was tested to extremes. She calls Micheál Martin arrogant, which is, was a par for the course. What do you make of this interview? Is it sort of like we're not going to be in government, so we just need to sort of prod our supporters out there, we're still around and active and all the rest of it?
Yeah, and like if you looked back, like you said earlier, like if Elon Musk and Trump are still best pals this time next year, like this time last year, it was anticipated that Mary Lou McDonald would be in a very different position than she is in now. And at the moment, she's on a bit of a repair mission. It's been a tough year for the party and they've not handled themselves as well as they could have done. And Caroline Dwan Stanley and Brian Stanley are highly regarded political operators in the Midlands and they would be in their own individual right very respected within the community. And I think Caroline, I can understand Hugh saying that maybe she took a bit long to resign, but I think it shows that she actually took a step back and reflected on it before jumping and just throwing a tantrum as she might have been accused of doing were she to have resigned earlier in solidarity with her husband. So I think at the moment, Mary Lou has a lot of work to do ahead of her in building the party up again. Like Sinn Féin would have been very strong in Laois and now to have nobody in the county is a major hit.
Yeah, you, in terms of Mary Lou McDonald's personal destiny, shall we put it like that, obviously, she's leader of the opposition. She could sit on the opposition bench for 5 years and wait for the next election to roll around. But 5 years is a long time, right? Mm. Obviously, there's a presidential election next year, which Sinn Féin will be nominating a candidate. I mean, do you see her doing the full 5 years or do you see her looking for an off-ramp of some description, whatever that might be? I know this is guesswork, but...
Well, it is. I mean, look, she said very clearly that her intention is to lead the party for however long remain or how long there will be between now and the next election. I mean, most observers would say it's probably 4 or 5 years. So it's her intention to do that. It's her intention to carry out a very, what she calls, significant reshuffle in the new year. So, you know, that's her plan as of now, but things change. I mean, you know, we're here now and, you know, Simon Harris is leader of Fine Gael. I don't think we would have sat here last year and thought that that would be the case at this time last year. And equally, you know, the Green Party have had a leadership change as well, Roderick O'Gorman replacing Eamon Ryan. So a lot can happen in that period. I don't see her running for the presidency. I think that's unlikely. I don't see Gerry Adams running for the presidency either. I'm not even sure if maybe Sinn Féin will put up a candidate or whether they might get behind a particular candidate. I mean, I've heard lots of talk about Jarlath Burns, the GAA president, potentially being a sort of Sinn Féin endorsed candidate. So, you know,
it sounds like you're leaning towards the idea that she'll do the longevity. She'll hang in there. That's what I'm picking up.
Well, I can only go off what she said because everything else is guesswork. I mean, it is hard in some ways to envisage her going into the next election, the third in a row, campaigning as the voice of change and putting forward the argument of change and proposing that she be Taoiseach, having been that proposition having effectively been rejected by the electorate in the last two elections. I mean, what she has said about the outcome of this election is that it has solidified the notion that the two-party system, Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael, is now dead.
But the reason I mentioned the presidency, I'm looking at what are the off-ramps available for her, and they don't seem that plentiful, to be honest.
They don't, and as I said, I don't think the presidency is one off-ramp, but I mean, equally, she could just decide that actually, you know, I've done my stint, I'm out. Yeah, she could return to the backbenches of Sinn Féin and let someone else take over.
Like, the longevity of political leaders now is so short. It's just across the system, right?
Yeah.
It is.
I mean, Micheál Martin is, I guess, the one that bucks the trend outlier, there. He's the outlier. But in general, yeah, we've had a lot of turnover in terms of party leaders in the last kind of 10, 15 years. I suspect, that the next election, whenever it is, will be her last election as leader of Sinn Féin. But that's if she gets that far.
I can't
predict one way or the other whether she will.
It's very responsible political reporting here.
It's called hedging my bets.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
One final thing before we go to the break. A very interesting story on page 3 of the Irish Times. I suppose it could have been on page 1 on another day, Aisling. And that's a number of young people on disability allowance soars. Now, on one level, you know, we know disability, people get payment. That's not a big deal. But the big increase, and also what's name-checked by Emmett Malone in the story, is mental health issues are among the reasons being attributed for this big rise. Now, I know this is a big quagmire of controversy, so I don't want to land you in any difficulties here, but I mean, it really struck me as an interesting social trend.
It is, and as someone who works with young people on a daily basis, the mental health issues are hugely concerning, and I think the generation that are in their 20s now, they're the generation affected most by COVID. And I hate bringing up that C word, but they missed out on so much and so much like socialisation. And now they're in workplaces maybe where they're working alone at home remotely, where they don't have the opportunity to socialise and meet new people in their lives. And their lives have become much smaller than, well, they would have been in my early 20s and late teens. So it is massively worrying. But more so for me, it flabbergasts me how you can have children with a diagnosed disability go from primary to secondary school to then go to third level, and any supports that they have just disappear overnight. We have this system where you might have had an SNA for your leaving cert, but then you go into third level and you've nothing. You have to start the application process all over again. So it's one thing to say that, you know, the number of people availing of a disability payment has increased, but the supports around those young people haven't. And they're crying out for these services, and the services themselves, mainly charities funded by government bodies, are really like struggling at the seams. So it's an issue that really needs to be tackled.
Yeah, I thought it was sort of a window into something bigger. Maybe the Irish Times will come back to it in the future. Listen, Hugh, could I talk to you a little bit about housing, which again, we start the year. Well, we're not started just yet. We're almost at the start of a new year, and it's the predominant social issue or economic issue out there. Everyone's moving to Newry, according to the Irish Times, where you can get cheaper housing and commute to Dublin.
Yeah, this is a Seanine Graham piece in the Irish Times today, which kind of picks up on this, what she's observed as this growing trend of people moving out of Dublin and moving to Newry. So, you know, just to kind of give your listeners an insight here, there's a couple who talk about it, renting a shoebox in an apartment in Dublin, and then they saw a three-bedroom house online for £950 a month. So the differential is just like staggering, really, when you consider house prices and apartment prices in Dublin and rental prices in Dublin. You know, the average price for a three-bed semi is in excess of €500,000 in Skerries. You know, you could get a similar property in Newry for around £212,000. So, I mean, it seems like a bit of a no-brainer to me.
Off to Newry, breaking news.
The only thing is, though, if you do move out, say if you're working in Dublin,
it's a long way away.
It's a long commute, and like, I'm from Tullamore, and for a couple of years I commuted up and down from Tullamore to Dublin. Door to door to here for Dix Lane, it's 50 minutes. But you hit Lucan and you could be 90 minutes sitting in Lucan in traffic some mornings. Like, I did the commute for a couple of years, and yes, in theory, if you want to have, and I would love to have a house of my own. I only have an apartment. But that life of maybe 2, 3, 4 hours a day commuting, it's miserable. And I think we don't talk about that a lot. There's a lot of people who moved out of the city in the hopes that maybe they would get to remote work, and now their employers want them back in the office.
Yeah,
maybe
they
three,
were told
to
work from home, and then a new boss arrived and said, no, I don't want you to work from home, you need to come in. And then suddenly your whole social status in terms of your setup is disrupted.
And it's like, and commuting life is a costly one. You've got to pay for fuel somehow, tolls. Or you've got tolls, you've got the train fare. You've also got the cost on your health of sitting in a car or sitting on a train or a bus for hours a day. And then just the lack of time with the people that you love. So, like, I don't think I can completely understand why people find themselves in that situation. And I know the housing situation is absolutely disgraceful, but I don't think it's a viable or sustainable solution either. As someone,
or at least put a health warning on it.
Yeah,
literally.
As someone who's been there, done that, I wouldn't recommend it.
Another story that's very interesting is in the Irish Times on opinion page, talking about, and people, when they hear this next headline, they're going to be a bit shocked. Could we be have too many houses being built, too much social housing being built, and the pendulum might swing too far in the other direction, that we're building too much social housing and there's a bubble growing, potentially, says Lorcan Sir, who's an academic. Does this hold any water with you? Are you? Is this something we could be worried about in a year or time, that we're going to swing the other direction and over-provision? I know people listening to me will be throwing things at their radio sets, but that is essentially what he's saying.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think in the situation where we're in a housing crisis and all, you know, the kitchen sink is being thrown at trying to find solutions and developing supply, there's going to be all sorts of knock-on unintended consequences in years to come. And so I think, you know, Lorcan Sir is making the point that it all feels a bit decidedly 2006 in terms of the provision of social housing and the risk associated with the kind of the massive increases in social housing output. But at the same time, I mean, we know that the best way of resolving the issue and the main issue in the housing and homelessness crisis is supply and delivering more supply in the coming years. And certainly we are way behind where we need to be. We had a decade of you know, underinvestment, under delivery of housing, and we're paying for that, and we continue to pay for that, and we continue to pay for it in terms of house prices here, rental prices, which is why people are kind of finding solutions in north of the border.
The Newry effect. Aisling, I mean, I know people will say, well, hang on, we don't have enough houses, but is there a danger that we overstimulate the sector, and how do you turn the tap off? So if you're building 60,000 and then you go to 40, you know, how do you come back in from there, I suppose, is the concern.
Well, like, at the end of the day, the population is growing consistently.
But so, at a slower rate than it used to be.
Yes, it is. But I think, look, Lorcan Sir is an expert in this area, so I'm not going to claim to know better than him. But we have underinvested massively in social housing over the last couple of decades, and that's caused a huge problem in the area. And I, at the moment now, I think it's about getting properties built. As long as they're built to a good standard, they are built in the right areas where they're close to amenities.
And where the demand is, that if people want apartments, yeah, we build apartments. If people want three beds, we build three beds, not the mismatch.
And I think as long as we're not making the mistakes of the past where blocks and blocks of apartments were built with no local shop or no local school, I think that's where the problems could...
And can I throw one other at you? The Indo front page, flatmates to compete with families for cost rentals. I suppose the headline, it kind of puts the two at cross purposes, or competitors, I suppose. But is that something you think is a good idea? Two people living together and they get a sort of a tax break to move into another property together, etc.?
To be honest, I was surprised that at the moment non-familial groupings were not permitted to do cost rental. Because how is that permitted? Is that not discrimination? But, you know, maybe I'm wrong on that. Look, I can see it causing huge headaches because, you know, getting a group of friends together to get everybody to sign the lease on time to pay the rent. Like, we've all been there, done that. It's never easy to go into a more formal negotiation where you're having to, you know, put forward what your annual salary is, what your entitlements are. I don't know how practical it is, but I also don't know how you can exclude, you know, friends and colleagues from applying for cost rental because they're not a family. That just doesn't seem democratic to me.
No, and romance is dead in this housing market. Everyone you meet who's trying to meet somebody, you say, you know, are you into this person? Is there a romance blossoming? And they're like, no, need two incomes, mate, you know. Mm-hmm. That tends to be the way it is. Let me get off housing because we'll be talking about this for the rest of the year. Anyway, this is not going away, as you've said. State papers, standard sort of, I suppose, chestnut at this time of the year, news chestnut. You, if I could go to you first, my personal favourite, but maybe I'm just an old hardened cynic, but Queen Elizabeth II had a dim view of orange marches. According to the Irish ambassador at the time, Ted Barrington, she said that the Orange Order and associated marches were a silly marching business, which has made unionists very upset, although they're not really upset with her. What do you make of that particular one for starters?
Yeah, I agree. I think it's one of it's a pick of the bunch, really, in terms of the comments, because obviously one-to-one conversations with the Queen are traditionally supposed to remain private, and the BBC in its very straight reporting of this revelation says that protocol was not followed by the Irish ambassador. So we have these comments attributed to the Queen as relayed by Ted Barrington, and these this exchange took place nearly 25 years ago in 2000 at a Buckingham Palace garden party in July of that year. And of course, this exchange has only been cleared for release subsequent to the Queen's death. Obviously, I doubt it would have come out if she were still alive. And Mervyn Gibson has already been the Grand Secretary of the Orange Order has already been out saying that he doesn't put much stock in these comments, and that Her Late Majesty always acknowledged and thanked the institution for our proclamation of loyalty each year on July 12th. And let it be clear, four words from a private conversation with no explanation, quoted by a foreign ambassador and open to interpretation, will not diminish the affection of the Orange Institution for Her Late Majesty, nor affect the loyalty to the
current
king.
It's sort of quite a cynic comment, silly marching business.
Yeah, no, it is. Yeah, and you could imagine her saying it for sure, but look.
It's just one of those, nobody will ever, for
nobody
obvious
will ever
reasons,
know. Nobody will ever
out
know.
There and everyone will take what they want out of it. Aisling, there's a few other bits and pieces around in the one that struck me because it was just so extraordinary was a threat by a shadowy group to poison the British water supply with weed killer. I mean, it's just
this shadowy
remarkable.
Group who in their letters referred to Her Majesty's government, which let the Gardaí and police services of Britain and Northern Ireland onto the fact that it wasn't a shadowy Republican group at all.
The shadowy loyalist group.
It wasn't even a shadowy loyalist group.
It was a shadowy group.
It was one man in Dublin from Scotland who lived in a world of his own, apparently, according to investigations.
Fantasist.
But it was interesting when you think about it in the context of today, because then police services, in all jurisdictions asked the media not to report on it, not to cover it, because it would cause public panic if it got out that somebody was going to put weed killer in the water. Well, then obviously nobody'd want to go near the water. And there was essentially a media blackout on it. But of course, in 2024, if something like that were to happen now,
it's brilliantly paternalistic. Can you imagine now? Sorry, can you not go on Twitter, please, and put this out?
And look, media blackouts do happen for very good reasons. But nowadays, I don't think something like that you'd be able to keep a hat on it.
It's a from a more forelock-tugging world, isn't it, which we don't live in anymore. One that also struck me was the Tony Blair looking extraordinarily politically naive, saying in the 2002 World Cup, Ireland have been knocked out and Irish fans might switch their allegiance over to England. Now, they do sort of point out that, he was a bit tired when he said that, but he also sounds extraordinarily naive when he said that.
Completely. I mean, that's and a surprising thing, really, for him to say, given that he's normally, politically astute around these matters. It's absolutely unconscionable.
Is that personal? Yeah.
That Irish fans would back England, or nationalists in the North would back England in the
even more so,
the absence of the Republic of Ireland having been knocked out. But of course, England only made it another round anyway before they were knocked out by Brazil.
She was moved.
Yeah.
I suppose it's like kind of unicorns, isn't it? I mean, it's sort of never going to happen. The other one that I noticed is the Irish Times page 6, Irish America appalled by, so we're going back into the 1940s here. The tail, I don't know why that one has been withheld so long, but obviously there's certain tiers of what's released when and so on. But the commemoration or the regards paid by Eamon de Valera at the time to the German ambassador, who was obviously part of the Nazi regime. We all know this happened. It stained the reputation of Eamon de Valera. But it's stuff still tumbling out about it and how it went.
Yeah, it's often said that Eamon de Valera signed the Book of Condolences, but of course there was no Book of Condolences. But he did indeed, on May 2nd, 1945, pay a visit to see the German minister to Ireland, Dr. Eduard Hempel, pay condolences after he'd heard about the death of Adolf Hitler in Berlin. And this has obviously been something that has often been used as a stick to beat Eamon de Valera with, and has obviously kind of fed this view that Ireland is kind of instinctively anti-Semitic, which is I don't think the case. But these tranche of documents released are basically relaying the anger of Americans at what Ireland had done, and that they could not fathom that they had done this. And, you know, there's one letter writer who says that, please give us all the facts concerning De Valera's actions on the death of Adolf Hitler. Local controversy makes immediate answer imperative, and on it goes.
Yeah, it's amazing that it's still causing news. It'll echo down through the decades, it would seem. Finally, Aisling, I'm going to leave this last one with you. None of us will be here within a decade if you go to page 3 of The Independent. Godfather of artificial intelligence said we'll all be extinct. That's all three of us, right? Let's just be absolutely clear on that. Nobody's going to escape. Professor Jeremy Hinton, presumably he'll be extinct as well, says we'll all be replaced by machines and chatbots, etc. See you in 10 years' time, we'll take a wager.
I think, you know, this is a man who obviously, like, he's a Nobel Prize winner for physics. He's obviously highly intelligent and all of that. But,
well, is he?
it's a bit scaremongering. Like, I use artificial intelligence on a daily basis for my work. I teach people how to use it. I also use it because I'm type 1 diabetic. So my insulin pump is managed by artificial intelligence. Been doing that for a couple of years now and I'm still alive and it hasn't attacked me. So, like, look, obviously, it's a massive change. And he's probably right in that it is akin to an industrial revolution, maybe not the industrial revolution, but it is a major change. And we're all having to get to grips with artificial intelligence. And governments and the EU, you know, various political organisations around the world, they are going to have to get on top of it and regulate it and make sure that there, you know, are safety systems in place for how it's being developed and to ensure that it's not being developed for nefarious purposes, because there'll always be the one that'll try it. But are we all going to be dead in the next 10 years thanks to the robots? Well, sure, like, if we were to believe stuff like that, sure, the Jetsons told me as a 5-year-old I was going to have a flying car, so...
Also, I'd like to tease it. Are we going to be dead or just replaced? There's a slight subtle difference in there. Maybe they come together.
I mean, he's making the comparison that technology had developed much faster than he expected and could make humans the equivalent of 3-year-olds and AI the grown-ups. But I think the caveat really is that he only thinks there's a 10-20% chance. Yeah. So, well, you know, it's still low.
I'm going to paraphrase more Queen Elizabeth
less
saying...
Likely than not.
The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.
Coming in...